101.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Ronald J. Sider, that's S-I-D-E-R. He's the author of a very new book just out this year called Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget, the U.S. National Budget. Fixing the National Debt. We're talking with Ron by phone. Ron, are you in Philadelphia? Where are you exactly?
I am in Philadelphia. I just came in from my garden.
We're glad you did. And this is a fascinating book, and I want to get to it very quickly. But before we do, let me just add my voice to those listeners have been hearing, reminding them that this is listener-supported radio. Your NPR affiliate here in central Illinois and Indiana. We try to bring some very good programs everywhere from Chicago down to south of Effingham in Illinois and over to Indianapolis, of course, in Indiana, like Keeping the Faith. But we do need listener support, and the money we raise by the 30th of June this year will be the money we have to operate on as a station next year. Now, as regular listeners know, I'm a volunteer here. That's one of the ways I contribute to WILL. But it takes hard cash. My wife and I do make a financial contribution as well because we appreciate so many of the programs, not just All Things Considered that's on before Keeping the Faith or This American Life that's after, but, of course, the other locally produced programs such as Focus and many others. So if you can help, please call. Really any time, but during this next hour would be great. 217-244-9455 with your pledge. You can use your credit card. You can later send in a check, but do call 244-9455. Or you can go online and pledge at willpledge.org. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thanks for joining and support for this public radio.
Steve, let me just add my encouragement. My wife and I give to NPR in Philadelphia. It's a great thing to contribute to.
Thank you very much, Ron. Well, let's get back to Ron Sider in terms of his book, Fixing the Moral Deficit. Why write this book now, Ron, and why this book?
Well, this society is in a huge debate over a very, very serious problem. We clearly have a federal deficit that's simply unsustainable. For all but 6 years in the last 50, the federal government has spent more money than it takes in. And for the last 10 years, we have been adding to that deficit in a huge way. We can't go on doing that. So we've got to solve that problem. But the way we solve it is absolutely crucial. If we don't solve it, it's not fair to our children and grandchildren. I say it's like using my grandchildren's credit card for expenses for things I want now, but I don't want to pay for. But some people say the way to solve it is to slash programs that help poor people. Fixing the deficit on the backs of the poor is just as immoral as borrowing on our grandchildren's credit card. So the way we solve this problem is absolutely crucial. If we don't stop huge deficits every year, you know, we're in economic trouble as well as moral trouble, but if we cut good programs that help poor people, then we're being fundamentally immoral.
Ron, you're the founder and the executive director of Evangelicals for Social Action. You're a conservative Christian in many ways theologically, and yet the perspective you take in this book, you try to be very balanced between, as you look at the various options put forward by Republican conservatives, by more progressive Democrats, and yet you try to come up with something in the middle, and yet that, as you suggest, avoids these things that you keep saying are flatly immoral on both ends.
Well, for all of my life, Steve, I am a Christian. I consider myself an evangelical Christian. I want to start with what the Bible tells us about God and salvation and so on. And if it seems to me that if you start at that point and want to be engaged in politics, you need to ask, what does the Bible say God cares about? And it looks to me like he cares a lot about the poor, as well as the sanctity of human life. And he cares a lot about racial justice and creation care, as well as sexual integrity. So I have, over my years, done a lot of work. My best-known book is Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. It talks about the whole issue of global poverty. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of verses in the Bible about God's very special concern for the poor. God measures societies by what we do to the people at the bottom. And that's why, as I listened to the debate beginning of last year, well, I was listening to it all along, but especially a year ago and a little more, I just got more and more disturbed and really angry at the kinds of proposals that were coming from some political quarters in terms of how to solve the budget deficit. There's simply no need to cut effective programs that help poor people, food stamps and foreign economic aid that saves millions of people from dying of hunger or AIDS in Africa and other places. No need to slash those programs in order to make genuine, effective steps to reduce our federal deficit.
Well, before we get to even halfway through this program, we have an hour to talk, which is wonderful to have time to actually get into depth to not only your analysis of the federal budget problems and the deficit, but also to look at some of your suggestions, your ways out, because you're very practical there, and you give people a lot of background, but also some directions to go that are hopeful. And I want to get to those before we get very far. But let's start, if we could, with some of the analysis of the problem. You talk early in this book about just the depth of poverty in the U.S. Could you share with listeners some of that information?
The richest nation in human history has the highest domestic poverty level of any industrialized nation. It's been that way for quite some time. It's increased over the last 10 years substantially. We now have roughly 15% of the American people below the poverty line. And that's not necessary. There are good programs that could turn that around, but that's where we are. So that's one of the crucial facts that I think we need to keep in mind.
And you point out that one in four African American or Hispanic families are in poverty.
Yes, the poverty level for African Americans and Hispanics has been much higher than the poverty level for European Americans for a long, long time, and that statistic continues. But the poverty issue is just one of several, you know, really crucial economic facts that I point out that we need to keep in mind as we look at the question of the federal deficit and ask what we should do about it. The first one is precisely the fact that we have large numbers of people in poverty, and in fact, we have good programs that reduce that. If we didn't have those programs, it would be a lot higher. So that's one fact. But a second fact is that there is enormous economic inequality in this country. The inequality between the top and the bottom is greater today than at any time since just before the Great Depression in 1928. And over the course of the years from 1928 to the present, it has varied dramatically. But today, the richest 1% own more wealth in the country than the bottom 90%. All of the growth in income, almost all the growth in income in 2010 went to the richest 1%. From 1993 to 2007, over 50% of all the increase in income in the country went to the richest 1%. From 2003 to 2007, 65% of all the growth in income went to the richest 1%. And in 2010, 93% of all the growth in income went to the richest 1%. If you divided the country up into 1,000 people, the richest 0.1% would get about $387 of all the $1,000 that would be in the country. So enormous inequality. It's been growing dramatically over the last 25 years. That's the second crucial economic fact when you ask the question, you know, what do we do about the deficit? Another issue is that, in fact, American taxes are relatively, not just relatively, they're quite low, both in comparison to historic U.S. standards. If you take the income tax, the top rate at one point was over 90%. It's only
if you were very wealthy, you'd be contributing 90% a year in taxes.
They weren't contributing 95% of all their income, but the top rate, you know, they paid lower percentages on a lot of their income, but on the last dollar they were paying, or last many dollars, they were paying over 90%. Today, you know, it's much, much lower. And in terms of other industrialized nations, the total take that the government gets in taxes, in all taxes, in the U.S. is much, much lower than it is in Canada or Western Europe. When people talk about high taxes, that's really kind of inaccurate in terms of the rest of the industrialized world.
Ron Sider, in reading your book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, you have many statistics, many graphs, but I want to compliment you on how clear particularly the graphs are. They really make your points in ways that even people like me who don't have a strong background in economics can understand it. And I do appreciate the way the book is put together. Let's move rather quickly to Chapter 3, where you talk about moral questions in this issue. You talk about the huge disparity between incomes and wealth. You give the economic data. But in Chapter 3, you raise moral issues. Now, you teach theology and ministry and public policy at a seminary there in Pennsylvania, so your background is in these kind of moral questions. Lead us through some of the issues you raise in that chapter.
Yeah, I'm professor of theology, holistic ministry, and public policy. I love the combination at Palmer Seminary at Eastern University. And I teach courses that range across that spectrum. What I try to do in that chapter is to ask, okay, what are the fundamental norms that we need in order to answer the question, how do we fix this problem? I also have a book on politics called Just Politics, and in that book I point out that every person, no matter who they are, has some set of values, fundamental norms, that guide their thinking about politics. And I want to go back to historic Christianity and to biblical faith when I get those norms. And so I talk about several different questions there. The first one is, who are we? Who are persons? Someone like Ayn Rand, the atheistic libertarian, says that we're just isolated individuals. On the other hand, some people like Marxists say we're fundamentally cogs in a huge machine. I say neither of those views is right. We are genuinely free persons with moral responsibility, but we're made for community. And we can't be fulfilled unless we live in a wholesome kind of communal setting. So to recognize our communal character is one essential part, one essential piece of a normative framework as you think about solving the deficit. I'm just not on my own. I have responsibility for others, and that's my second question, what's my responsibility to the neighbor? Again, Ayn Rand said nothing. In fact, she thinks it's immoral to be concerned with the neighbor. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. So biblical people need to have a genuine concern for the neighbor. Another crucial question is, you know, what is justice? Does justice demand total equality of wealth and income, as some kind of Marxists, well, all Marxists, I guess, say? Or on the other hand, you've got libertarians who say that you have justice as long as the procedures are fair, no matter what the outcomes. So if you have great extremes of wealth and poverty, but the law courts and so on are operating fairly, then that's justice. I go back to the Bible again to try to look for a definition of justice, and one of the things I do there is to go back to the Old Testament and what it tells us about the land. Agricultural society, land's the basic capital, the basic means of creating wealth, and what happens is that every family gets their own land. If they act responsibly, they can earn their own way. Furthermore, every 50 years, the land goes back to the original owners, no matter how or why they lost their land. And the prophets shout and scream when the kings allow large numbers of farmers to lose their land because a few powerful people are seizing it. So what the Bible tells us is that God wants every family and every person to have access to the basic capital, the basic means of producing wealth, so that if that person and family acts responsibly, they can earn a decent living and be dignified members of their community. That's my basic definition of justice. And then, of course, I have to deal with the huge current debate about the role of government. You know, we've got libertarians running around, and some of them are Christians, who basically say that, yeah, we're supposed to care about the poor, but government's not supposed to do that. That's something for families and for churches and synagogues and private nonprofits and so on. So I try to ask, is there anything in the scriptures that tells us about whether or not government has a role? And what I say there is, it's certainly wrong to say that the only agency in society that cares about the poor is government. That's not true. Family has responsibilities. Religious institutions have responsibilities to the poor. Nonprofits have responsibilities. So does business. But the Bible also says that the king is supposed to do justice. The Hebrew words are mishpat and tzedakah. And those words mean both fair courts and fair economic outcomes. There's a marvelous story in Nehemiah where the ruler is after the captivity, so there's not a Jewish king, but a Jewish leader comes back from the imperial city that, in fact, controls all the area and is put in charge of the country, and he discovers after a time of almost famine that many of the poor Jews have lost their land. They've sold themselves into slavery or mortgaged their land in huge ways, and they're in desperate trouble. And Nehemiah, the ruler, the king, or if you like, the government, is furious. He calls an assembly, and he denounces the rich, in this case, their fellow Jews, the rich folk who had done these unjust things. He says, give back their land immediately and give them back the interest you charge them. It's a clear case of government stepping in a case of injustice and righting an economic wrong and making sure that the people have the economic resources they need in order to care for themselves and earn a decent living. So you get a very significant definition of justice and a clear teaching that government has an important role. Not the only role, but one crucial, important role in working at problems of poverty. And I'd like to point out that you know, there's factual data that underlines the importance of that. I'm delighted that churches and synagogues and lots of people, you know, have good food pantries and provide food. Tens of millions of Americans need food assistance every month. But in fact, in spite of the tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people who are doing good work in those private food pantries, only 6% of all the food that is provided to needy people for food assistance every month, only 6% comes from private agencies. 94% comes from government. So government has a crucial role in overcoming poverty. Those are some of the key kind of normative principles that I bring when I approach the question of how do we solve the federal deficit.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Ron Sider, S-I-D-E-R, about his new book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Federal Budget and Fix the National Debt. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Let me encourage listeners who have a question or comment to give us a call. In Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL within the 217 area code. If you're listening and it's a long-distance call, you may join the conversation by punching in 1-800-222-9455. And that's true also if you're listening on the Internet. Of course, this program is heard by many on the Internet live, or also you can hear it when it's archived in a few days or a week. It'll be there for you to hear it in its entirety at your convenience, and that's at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And just leave the G off of keeping. We're so informal here. So do give us a call on either of those numbers. And let me remind listeners, if you'd like to make a contribution, it also that number ends WILL 9455, but it's 217-244-9455 if you'd like to make a pledge. Or you can go to willpledge.org. Getting back to our guest, Ron Sider, I see we do have a call waiting for us. Looks like online, our toll-free line already. Let's go to that call. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Good to hear you, Mr. Sider. As I was hearing you talking about Christians and their attitudes, I was reminded of the small town I live in Eureka. And as you may know, it's the college home of Ronald Reagan, and the point, how he related is, I remember since the 1980 campaign, so many Christians, whether there's a good Mennonite contingent, Apostolic Christian, there are two Bible churches, Nazarene, Baptist, Lutheran, basically a pretty conservative town, but so many of them seem to think that if you're conservative in the theological area, you have to be conservative in the political area, and I realize there's no They're Christians of all types, but it just greatly troubles me that it's almost like a parroting of Ronald Reagan economics that has to be our approach to government. And as you were talking just a few minutes ago about how in a lot of ways the federal tax rates are really quite low compared to what they used to be and probably to other countries. And I wonder if you could speak to this dilemma about persons who are conservative theologically, who then almost think that you have to be conservative in the economic area.
Well, I've complained for a long time, for decades, that lots of evangelical Christians are really not biblical enough when it comes to their politics, and it's precisely at the point that you're mentioning. As I said earlier, if you're going to be biblical in your politics, you have to ask what the Bible says God cares about. And it looks to me like God cares about the sanctity of human life, so I am conservative on sanctity of human life issues and justice for the poor. The Bible cares about marriage and about racial justice and creation care. And the good news is, well, first of all, it was never true that all evangelical Christians were Republicans or right-wing people, and Republicans are broader than right-wing folk, but there's kind of a stereotype out there that evangelical Christians are the religious right, and there are lots of evangelicals that are, but there's always been the number of evangelicals who were not. But in the last decade, there's been a major change in the evangelical world, and there's a new evangelical center emerging. The National Association of Evangelicals is the largest movement or organization of evangelicals in the country, about 30 million people represented. And their official public policy document is called For the Health of the Nation. You can get that on my organization. You can get it on the NAE organization or my organization, Evangelicals for Social Action. Just Google that, and you'll get the document for the health of the nations. And it clearly says that we've got to be concerned, yes, with the sanctity of human life, and yes, with marriage, but also with economic justice, and with human rights, and with the care for creation. And the NAE, now the National Association of Evangelicals, like my own organization, Evangelicals for Social Action, we're not the same organization, but the National Association of Evangelicals is currently taking excellent stands on immigration. They clearly have a concern for creation care, nuclear issues, and so on. So there's a lot of evidence that the old stereotype that all evangelicals are religious right is never was entirely true, and it's certainly less true now than it was 15 years ago.
I like your response about, for instance, going back to, I don't think you mentioned, but I think you alluded to it, the year of the Jubilee in the Old Testament. And it seems like if you read parts of the Old Testament, that there's just so much attention paid to the alien, to the poor in your midst, and to those who are in debt that God demands justice of.
I mentioned it briefly when I was talking about land in the Old Testament, and one part of that biblical teaching on the land is precisely the Leviticus 25 passage on the Jubilee, where every 50 years the land goes back to the original owners, and doesn't say that it only goes back if they've been responsible and worked hard. It just says the land goes back to the original owners. Another interesting part of the Old Testament teaching is that the prophets say that one of the reasons that the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel, those two Israelite kingdoms, one of the major reasons they were taken into captivity was precisely because of the economic justice. The other was idolatry. But because of the economic justice that the kings and the powerful created and allowed. But the prophets say sometime in the future things are going to be different. The Messiah is going to come. And when the Messiah comes, they say, every person will sit under his own vine and his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. In other words, everybody will have their land back, and there will be justice for everyone, because the poor will have the economic means to earn their own way. Now, I don't think we should try to figure out who owned the land 50 years ago, but the principle there that whatever the essential capital in a society is, and in an information society, it's essentially knowledge. So whatever the basic means of producing wealth is, needs to be distributed in such a way that everybody has access up to the point where if they work responsibly and act faithfully, they can be dignified members of their community and have a decent living. And if you take that standard for justice and apply it to U.S. society or any society around the world, it demands really major economic change. For starters, we'd have to make the schools work for everybody, not just white suburban kids, but also inner-city African-Americans and Hispanics.
Let me thank the caller for those good questions, and thank our guest, Ron Sider, who's the author of Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Federal Budget, published just this year by InterVarsity Press. We're about halfway through our program, and I want to get to some of the proposals that our author has on fixing the national debt and the problems with the budget. But let me remind listeners, again, we are here at WILL at our end of the fiscal year fund drive, and do encourage Keeping the Faith listeners to make a pledge at willpledge.org online, or you may call anytime at your convenience, 217-244-9455. We try here on Keeping the Faith to have many different types of opinions and voices from the various religious communities, engaging with ideas that are important to our communities, to our nation, to our world. We try to have discussions that cover all aspects of faith and spirituality and ethics and values. And we believe in that process we get broader perspectives and create greater understanding between people of different viewpoints. And an example today is in dealing with a very important, one of the most important national issues that is represented in Ron Sider's book, Fixing the Moral Deficit. So do help support these kind of conversations here on WILL. Take a moment, call 217-244-9455. If not now, immediately after this program and before This American Life comes on. Or go to willpledge.org. Thank you for making a pledge. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, I'll be traveling again, and we'll have an archive program. The following week, Jennifer Walling will be our guest from the Illinois Environmental Council in Springfield. On July 15, Ardella Perry Osler, the author of Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. A very helpful and insightful book. That'll be on July 15. Later in August, we'll have a recent graduate from the University of Illinois, Sean Denny, talking about the solar decathlon house that was entered in the national competition and did quite well in Washington, D.C. recently. And later in August, Elizabeth Meyer Bolton will be our guest, talking about the SALT, S-A-L-T, project that tries to help people understand how they can pass on in a helpful way what they're enthusiastic about in terms of their version of a progressive style of Christianity. We also have Muslim guests who will be speaking with us. That date hasn't been firmed up yet, but we're working on that. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Let me remind you of the numbers to call if you want to join this conversation today with author Ronald J. Sider, S-I-D-E-R. You can call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call from anywhere in the continental U.S. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area in the area 217, call 333-9455. Ron, in your book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, you talk about some of the current proposals sort of on the table, and you say they're simply not good enough. Tell us why.
Well, we have from Congressman Ryan, who's chair of the Budget Committee in the Republican-controlled House. We have the proposals that the House have passed for the 2012 budget, and we have President Obama's 2012 budget proposals. Neither have been, in fact, approved and signed into law, but we have two quite different proposals. In the case of the Ryan budget, which the Republican House actually passed, we have an increase in defense spending by $228 billion over the next 10 years, even though the U.S. currently spends as much on the military budget as all other nations in the world combined. But the Ryan budget wants to increase that by a lot. The Ryan budget wants to slash programs that empower poor Americans. The Ryan budget wants to keep all of the Bush area tax cuts, even though 65% of all those tax cuts went to the richest 20%. And on top of that, he wants to give another $265,000 a year in tax cuts to people who make over $1 million. The Ryan budget wants to slash government programs, especially those that empower poor people. It would cut food stamps by $133 billion over 10 years. It would cut Pell Grants, which help poor kids go to college. It would cut Medicaid, which is health care for poor people, dramatically. It would privatize Medicare, health care for elderly folk. And because of the huge tax cuts for the rich, it doesn't even end the budget deficit over the next 10 years. It adds another $3 trillion to the federal debt. On the other hand, we've got President Obama's...
Ron, before you get to saying some words about Obama's proposed budget, we do have a caller, and I want to get them in so they don't have to wait too long on the line. This is line number one. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, you spoke earlier in a couple of responses about the sanctity of marriage, and I'm interested in hearing your views about the legalization of gay marriage, same-sex marriage. I've spoken to friends of mine, Canadian evangelicals in Canada, as you know. There is a federal law that permits same-sex marriage. And these evangelicals are persuaded that it's a good thing for the sanctity of marriage. That is to say, it makes it clear that when a minister, a pastor, a rabbi marries two individuals, that those two individuals are married before God, and the state's endorsement or permission is a different matter. And I wonder whether or not you would be willing to agree with those evangelicals in Canada who actually embrace the legalization of gay marriage in Canada as actually contributing to a greater sense of the sanctity of marriage. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that because that's a separate topic, but I have written on that. I care about it. Very briefly, I am in favor of civil rights for all people, including gay Americans. I think that as evangelicals, we must be vigorously opposed to gay bashing. We must be sensitive to young people in our congregations that are struggling with their sexual identity. I think that evangelicals, by and large, have done all of that very, very poorly. I'm also in favor of civil unions that would include gay folk. But it seems to me that the historic definition of marriage, which is between a man and a woman, which has been the position of every civilization for millennia, is something that should not be tossed out. I think the state's fundamental interest in marriage is not about the romantic relationship between two people. It's about the next generation of good citizens. And the sociological data is quite clear that it's better for kids if they grow up with their biological moms and dads. And obviously the only two parents that can do that for the kids is the mother and father who have conceived those children. So I think it would be a mistake to embrace gay marriage, although I think that there are a whole range of civil rights that gay couples should rightly have, and that we could embed that in laws about civil union.
Thank you for that question, caller, but let's do get back to our announced topic, which is about the current book, Fixing the Moral Deficit. Ron, you had talked about the problems you saw with Ryan's proposal that's passed the Republican-controlled House, and you started to talk about the problems with the Obama budget proposal.
Right. President Obama wants to keep, rather than cut, effective programs that empower poor people, food stamps, for example, Pell Grants, economic foreign aid, Medicaid. He wants to increase spending somewhat for infrastructure, roads, bridges, high-speed rail lines, schools, and so on. Those are things that, in fact, will help with a better economic future down the road. His tax proposals include keeping many of the Bush-era tax cuts, but not those that affect people earning more than $250,000 a year. He has what he calls a Buffett rule for Warren Buffett, the wealthy billionaire who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last year saying, stop coddling the rich, and proposed higher taxes for really rich people like himself, so that people, according to Obama's proposals, people earning $1 million or more would have to pay at least 30% income tax. Furthermore, one of the reasons the rich pay so small amount of taxes is that they only pay 15% on capital gains and income from stocks. I don't see any reason why a doctor or plumber who earns a lot of money should pay 35% as the highest income tax rate, and somebody earning millions of dollars Mr. Romney does, for example, from stocks and things of that sort, should pay at only the 15% rate. I think those proposals are largely good. I would criticize Obama at a number of points. He wants to basically continue defense spending at current levels, even though we spend as much as all other nations in the world combined. I think we could cut the defense budget by $100 billion and still be entirely safe. Another major problem is that President Obama does not spell out a way to get to a more or less balanced budget. His proposals would actually have the federal debt increasing by over $6 trillion in the next 10 years, and that's simply not good enough. The president owes us a proposal that spells out how we can make changes in a whole variety of things, including Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, and cut out programs that were designed to help poor people but are not working, but keep the programs that really are working to empower poor people. And he hasn't done that, and he needs to do that. So I'm not satisfied with either set of proposals, but I certainly think that the Ryan proposals that really try to balance the budget on the backs of the poor and give the rich still more tax cuts, increase the military budget even more, that's just fundamentally wrong.
And you propose in your book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, in Chapter 5 and 6, what you call a better way. And you admit it's a hard thing to come up with, but you start off by basically saying we need to raise taxes and we need to cut some spending, but not in certain very vital programs that help the poor. And since this program is broadcast in the Farm Belt here in Illinois and Indiana, why don't we start off with one of your most controversial suggestions in terms of the farm program?
Well, I think that there are aspects of the farm program that are simply not needed. In part, a great deal of the federal money that is spent on farm programs go to a small percent of very wealthy farmers. I'm glad to help poor, struggling farmers, but I don't think we need to give millions of dollars to huge. Corporate farms. So I do favor cutting some of the subsidies that we give to farm programs. That's only one relatively small piece of the whole picture, but it's one thing that, in fact, I think needs to be done.
Let's talk about raising taxes, another controversial part.
Yeah, my basic norm there is to say I think we need approximately 50-50 in terms of cutting expenditures and increased revenue. Both of the important bipartisan commissions, one was appointed by President Obama, Simpson-Bowles, widely discussed when it reported the end of 2010, widely affirmed, but it's not in fact implemented. But their basic proposal was to say, we've got to cut expenditures and we've got to increase revenue. Almost everybody agrees that that is the case, but politically, Republicans have basically said no increases in taxes, period. I've amused and interested in the story of a very, very conservative friend of mine in Southern California who has given millions of dollars to very conservative causes for decades, a very conservative Republican. But a couple of years ago, he got so mad with the Republicans saying, never, 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 under any circumstances will we raise taxes when the California budget was in crisis. He went out and registered as a Democrat, headline stories in Southern California. I think we've got to increase revenue, and we've got to cut expenditures.
We have another caller waiting. Ron, let me interrupt for you to go to line number one. Yes, a question or comment?
Yes, both. I hope your guest realizes that when we talk about shared austerity and cutting particularly social welfare programs, we are essentially saying some people are going to die prematurely. that the elderly, when they see their Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other social welfare programs cut, are not going to live long enough to see the benefits, if there are benefits. And as for their children having their future jeopardized by these programs, if we do not continue to fund education at a high level, they are never going to see any benefit from these programs because they won't have the education and the skills to profit by a more productive future. As for not having the money to fund these programs, when 1% of the population has more wealth than 90% at the bottom, there's plenty of money to fund these programs.
I'm going to let our guest respond, but I think you misheard him. He has not suggested on the radio or in his book cutting the basic social welfare programs or education. All he's suggested so far is cutting the defense budget.
That I would agree with emphatically. And there are other areas that we could cut waste, subsidies to the oil industry and some other industries which don't need them.
Let's let our guest respond. Go ahead.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I think that you make very important points that, in fact, I make in the book. I do think, and I'm a senior, that there are some changes that we have to make in Social Security and Medicare. I'm opposed to privatizing them, and that's the proposal that a number of Republicans have made. I think that's a mistake. Social Security is a marvelously successful program. Without Social Security today, almost half of all of our seniors would be in poverty. Because of Social Security, it's less than 10%. Now, that's a pretty good program. But we've got to make some changes. I think that seniors should be leading the way to say, we have to sacrifice some more. And at this point in time, the government spends $4 on every senior for every $1 it spends on people from 0 to 18. And I don't think that's a fair balance. I think that we should be spending more, in fact, on improving education for all of our young people. We should not privatize Medicare and Social Security, but we have to make some changes. So,
you do suggest in your book that people above a certain income level who are also getting Social Security could certainly be paying taxes on that Social Security.
Yeah, I'm still working, and I don't make a huge income. I'm just a theology professor, but I make a good income, and I don't pay taxes on a significant part of my Social Security. I think I should. That's an example of how we ought to increase taxes on people well below $250,000 a year. I don't agree with President Obama, that we can't increase taxes on people unless they're making $250,000 a year. I think people like myself ought to pay some more taxes. And in my book, I say that anybody who files federal income tax ought to pay a little bit. Even if it's just $25, we need a shared sense that we're in this together, that we've got to solve our deficit crisis together. And I want everybody to be involved in that process. But I think the people who make the most money should be paying the most taxes, and they should be paying higher taxes than they are. So there are a whole variety of things we need to do to Social Security to make it more sustainable. We can increase the age when you get it with full income. We can, for one thing, taxes for Social Security are not paid at all on your income if it comes from dividends. And I think it's dividend income ought to pay taxes as well. And you don't pay on your regular income beyond $106,800 a year. I think you ought to pay on all of your income for Social Security purposes. So there are ways to increase the income. I think also that wealthy people should get a smaller amount of Social Security than they currently get.
And in terms of the social programs that you see are very effective, we haven't really talked about those and don't have a whole lot of time, but there are four or five you list that you say are very effective and they should not be cut.
Yeah, I mean, food stamps is a marvelous example. Tens of millions of Americans get it. It doubled basically in the last 4 years, worked exactly as it's supposed to work in a time of economic trouble because millions and millions of people fell into poverty, and so they needed food stamp aid. But half or more of the people who get food stamps only get it for 6 to 8 months. They need it for a short time, they get it, and then they go off. It's efficient, there's very little fraud in it, it's not out of control. When the economy improves, the number of people getting food stamps will drop. That's one example of a program that shouldn't be cut, and Congressman Ryan wants to cut it by $130 or so billion dollars over 10 years. That's wrong. Another example is Pell Grants. You know, I want to empower poor kids to go to college. That's not a welfare program that creates dependency. If you don't study for a year, you don't get it. You're off. But if you do work hard, then you can acquire an education and earn your way for a lifetime. Again, Congressman Ryan wants to slash Pell Grants from $5,500 to $3,000 a year.
And we do have another caller on line number one. If you could ask your question quickly, please. Thanks.
Yes, I simply want to compliment your guest on clarifying his views and to agree firmly with his call for taxation of dividends. And thank you so much for having him.
Appreciate it. Thanks. And, Ron, there are a couple other programs you specifically list that you think are very helpful in terms of social programs.
Well, the Earned Income Tax Credit is one of the very successful programs. Republicans and Democrats have endorsed it. If you're working at a low wage, then for every dollar you earn, you get another 40 cents as a tax credit. And if you don't owe any taxes because your income is still quite low, then you still get it. It's a refundable tax credit, so you get that payment from the government. It lifts millions of people out of poverty. There have been studies. It increases the work behavior of low-income people. That's a marvelous anti-poverty program that lifts millions of children out of poverty and millions of others out of poverty. We ought to strengthen it, certainly not cut it.
We're down to our last 6 minutes or so with Ron Sider, S-I-D-E-R, Ronald J. Sider, author of Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, earlier, Fixing the Moral Deficit is his current book, published by InterVarsity Press, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget, the Federal Budget, A Way to Fix the National Debt. Ron Sider is the founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. You may go to that website, evangelicalsforsocialaction.org, to learn more about that organization. He's also been involved in several other interesting things involving intergenerational justice, for example. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Evangelicals for Social Action has a campaign going on right now, in fact, a campaign for intergenerational justice. It's focused on the debt and deficit crisis, and we're saying we want to call grandparents and their grandchildren and everybody in between to a campaign that says we must, in fact, reduce the federal deficit over a period of 5 years or so. We need to basically get essentially to a balanced budget, but we have to do that in a just way. It's not fair to our children and grandchildren to continue borrowing as they'll have to repay, but we have to get to a balanced budget in a way that's fair to the poor. And I would love to have people go to Evangelicals for Social Action, see our declaration on intergenerational justice, and join us in the campaign, because the only way we're going to get that is if thousands and thousands, literally millions of people tell their politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, that we've got to deal with the budget deficit, but we've got to do it in a way that's fair.
Tell us about Circle of Protection.
That was a wonderful movement last year. Evangelicals for Social Action was part of it.
But also many liberal, very liberal National Council of Churches was part of it.
Certainly, and Evangelicals and the Catholic bishops. The National Association of Evangelicals leadership was involved in it. Basically, it said as the politicians were dealing with the federal debt limit and huge conflict there, There was talk about slashing government programs, and there was agreement that if they were going to have to cut programs dramatically, then certain kinds of programs that help poor people, including food stamps and the Earned Income Tax Credit and several others, that those would be excluded from the dramatic cuts. And that really protected tens of billions of dollars of aid to poor people.
At the end of your book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, you talk about action steps that people can take. And one that you suggest is explore ways to simplify your own lifestyle and reduce personal debt. Why that?
Well, I think there's been a general mood in the country over the last decade plus that's allowed us to be careless with our borrowing. And individuals have done that as well as our governments. And so we need to become more responsible at all of those levels. And one part of how you do that is to look more carefully at what you need to spend on yourself and what's frivolous and unnecessary and where you can cut back. I've been advocating for decades that, you know, in my book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, that in order to give more to empower poor people around the world, both here and abroad, you know, we need to spend less on ourselves so we can share more with others. A Catholic saint said we must live more simply so that others may simply live. And I think that's a good principle.
We are at the end of our time here on Keeping the Faith with our guest today, Ronald J. Sider, speaking with us by phone from Philadelphia. I want to thank you for taking time on your Sunday evening to talk with us about these important issues. His book is Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget. Came out just this year by IVP Books, InterVarsity Press. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me tell you again how you can learn more about the organization that Ron is the founder for and the executive director. Go to evangelicalsforsocialaction.org. And again, a reminder to make a pledge to WILL AM 580. You can do that by calling 244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. These programs are possible only because of contributions made by listeners who care about the station and Illinois Public Media. Coming up on Keeping the Faith, next week will be an archived program. On July 8th, we'll be talking with Jennifer Walling about the Illinois Environmental Council and its work in Springfield. She's the executive director of that organization. On July 15, our guest will be Ardella Perry Osler. Her recent book is called Learning to Love Olivia, A Daughter's Journal of Her Mother's Journey Through Alzheimer's. Then coming up later in August, we'll be learning about the Solar Decathlon House, a house designed by University of Illinois engineering and architecture students that's very efficient, and the SALT Project with Elizabeth Meyer Bolton. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Mary Ellen O'Shaughnessy was going to retire from her University of Illinois job next year. But a formula change and fears of pension reform changed her mind.
I really felt to protect my own self-interest, I had to retire now.
And she's not alone. U of I retirements are up by nearly a third.
Quality people, they've been here a long time. They hold very responsible positions. And poof, they're gone.
I'm Jim Meadows. Pensions, Brain Drain, and the U of I, Monday on Morning Edition.
Thanks to your support this year, The news and information you value is here every day.
With Illinois Public Media News, I'm Jeff Bossert.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.
For Illinois Public Media News, I'm Sean Powers.
Support your source for balanced news and information, and follow our progress on WILL.illinois.edu.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM.